I'm going to first repeat a little story from Robert Kirshner about the acceptance of dark energy today. And then I'm going to go through and outline Newton's methodology. I'm claiming a key part of it is acceptance, empirically guided by theory-mediated measurements. And I'm going to say more about what's involved. Then I'm going to give a classic example. Niash, this is the example you made sure that I put in when we were in that session here for the C-chips. So I was trying to find a way to squeeze enough room for it, and it's there. Okay, so, and then the fourth section will look at the determining cosmological parameters and supporting dark energy. So acceptance of dark energy today. This is from Robert Kirshner's book, Our Extravagant Universe, and a big long subtitle. First edition of the book came out in 2002. In 2004, there was a fourth printing and first paperback edition, and he added a little epilogue, a little appendix. And this is from that. So here, we've done these calculations in a standard lambda cold dark matter universe. The energetic young speaker at the front of the Phillips Auditorium at the Center for Astrophysics, Katherine Johnson, a professor from Wesleyan, was setting the stage for presenting her new results on galaxy cannibalism. There were 100 people in the room for the Tuesday astronomy colloquium. Katherine had a lot of new results to share, and she wasn't wasting any of her time or theirs by justifying the cosmology she had assumed. By the way, those of us in lesser disciplines like philosophy are amazed that the regular Thursday afternoon thing would have 100 people in it. But,
That's only 1%.
Nobody blinked. Nobody asked a question. But my mind, always unreliable after 4 p.m. in a darkened room, started immediately to drift into speculation. How could a lambda universe, two-thirds dark energy and one-third dark matter, be the standard picture in the autumn of 2003? Just 5 years earlier, cosmic acceleration had seemed unbelievable, and dark energy in its guise as a cosmological constant had been a notoriously bad idea, personally banished by Albert Einstein. What had changed? And then he starts going through, and the first part of the answer, supernova results had become both more numerous and more accurate. Then he says, okay, it wasn't just this. And then he goes on and talks about the supporting results from galaxy clustering observations. And then he says, it wasn't even both of these together. And when you're reading it, you're very impressed by all the improvements and thinking, wow, that should have done it for each of these steps. But the decisive new evidence on his view came from the green measurements of the cosmological parameters from the cosmic microwave background radiation. And here's his discussion of this. Even though the cosmic microwave background measurements don't detect cosmic acceleration directly as the supernova measurements do, taken together, they point with good precision to a universe with both dark matter and dark energy. Things were fitting together, and the better you measured them, the better they fit. Quantitative agreement is the ring of truth. This is the reason why, by the autumn of 2003, our colloquium speaker didn't bother to make the case that a lambda-dominated universe was the right picture. Now I want to talk a little bit about Newton's methodology. I'm claiming this is an example of the methodology endorsed by Newton in action. So first, philosophers of science in the last century spent a lot of time taking as their model of scientific inference the hypothetico-deductive model. So on this methodology going along with this account of scientific inference, theories lead to predictions about the world. We experiment or observe in order to see whether these predictions come about. And empirical success is just accurate prediction. Now, Newton's methodology adds to this at least these three things, maybe more. I'm not claiming to have gotten everything. First thing is a richer ideal of empirical success, not just accurate prediction of phenomena. It requires, in addition, accurate measurement of the parameters by the predicted phenomena. Newton, when he introduces the theoretical concepts at the beginning of the Principia, he starts with the concept of a centripetal force, and he sets it up, well, we'll see, so that various aspects, let's, for example, the power law of the force can be empirically determined by measurements from phenomena. Then he, okay, the next thing, so a richer ideal of empirical success, then closely related to that, theory-mediated measurements. To exploit, insofar as possible, theory-mediated measurements from phenomena so as to give empirical answers to theoretical questions. I can't resist his account of centripetal forces and being able to just get at them empirically. Just as he did in his light and colors paper with what he called rays, so in his initial definition of centripetal force, and even later, all the way through to the theory of gravity, was separating. He was starting with concepts that would be defined in ways that would allow you to get at them and empirically establish features of them independently of any deeper account of what the more fundamental causal explanations would be. And this put him at variance with the mechanical philosophy, Huygens, Leibniz, and before them, Descartes, where the key was to find some way, some story that would give you an account of the motion phenomena by things colliding with each other to make motion phenomena intelligible. For Newton is separating what we can empirically get at by taking these weaker definitions of just with and then using phenomena to carry information. I'll give some examples of this in action. That was so vague that probably didn't do much for you. Okay, and then...
each of these, I'm trying to see the example of where Newton actually did this. So Richard's idea of empirical success. So you said he has to, but you have to measure parameters. What parameters did he measure?
For example, one of the inferences that opened the argument, in fact, the inference that opens the argument for universal gravitation, is to argue for the centripetal direction of the force deflecting, say, Jupiter into its orbit, centripetal direction directed at the center of the sun, from Kepler's area law. So the phenomena is the area law. The very first proposition in the Principia is if you have a body that's being deflected from inertial force, from its inertial motion by a force directed at an inertial center, then the body will move in a plane and the rate at which it sweeps out areas will be constant. So if you were doing hypothetical deductive, that would be it, right? I could explain the area law by assuming the centripetal direction. Newton doesn't actually cite that theorem. He does cite the next one, which is the converse of it. If you have a body moving in a plane, sweeping out equal areas and equal time, so the rate at which areas are swept out is constant, with respect to an inertial center, then the force that's deflecting the body from its inertia, from the tangent, is directed right at that center. And it's better than that. He has a corollary to this. If at this instant, imagine my elbow is Jupiter, and your head is the sun. No, I need something over. Okay, Dylan, your head is the sun. And if at this instant the aerial rate were increasing, if the second derivative of the area were positive, force is off-center forward. If it were negative, it's off-center backwards. Notice you're using information from orbits to carry information about the direction. And he has two separate arguments for the inverse square. The one I'm going to talk about, the precession theorem, which I'll go through in a few moments. And he also has, and I have it in some later slides if we get to it, if people want, the harmonic law for a system of orbits. So the absence of unaccounted precession for a given orbit is measuring the inverse square variation of gravitation toward the sun for the distances explored by that orbit. And then from the harmonic law, you're getting that having the harmonic law hold, the mean distances cubed over the period squared is the same constant for all those orbits, is measuring the inverse square relation of the centripetal accelerations at the mean distances of those orbits. Okay, so now you've got sort of two measurements for the inverse square. And if for Newton, the inference is even in the places not being explored by any planets, that inverse square holds. There's an inverse square centripetal acceleration would be there. Okay, so that's the theory-mediated measurements at work. Okay.
I'm just wondering what the parameter would be, but I guess I'm not quite sure what you're explaining is this g. The mass of the sun is the parameter.
No, no. In this case, where the parameter is the power law for the centripetal force. In this case, in this example, and then an earlier one, it was the direction, what the center is, where that was coming from the area law ones. From the area law, he infers the centripetal force is the thing that's maintaining the planet in its orbit, and then from these two different phenomena, Kepler's harmonic law for the relation among the accelerations at the mean distances are coming from that if R cubed over T squared is the same constant for all those orbits, then you have the inverse square relation. And similarly with the precession, which we'll get to in more detail. Okay. And then to do this stuff, you need to have acceptance of theoretical background assumptions, because it's theoretical background assumptions that are giving you the systematic dependencies that are letting you have the phenomena carry this information. Okay. Now, I want to now give an example. Newton cites absence of precession as evidence of the inverse square variation of. I've more or less done this, so I won't bother doing it. But I do want to put this back. This part I already said it verbally, but I want to put this up because if you just had, like here, you have the conditional in addition to this biconditional that the zero precession is giving you the inverse square, and if you did have the inverse square, you would get the zero precession the really neat thing is in addition to that you have a whole bunch of these biconditionals. Forward precession, that's equivalent to having the power thing fall off faster than the inverse square. Backwards precession, that's P negative, backwards precession, is equivalent to having it fall off less fast than the inverse square. So you're actually measuring the inverse square. And notice you can apply it in the presence of perturbations. If you can account for all of the precession on any given planet due to, say, perturbations, then the zero left over is measuring the inverse square of gravity toward the sun.
All of these implications are
I couldn't hear.
All of these implications hold under the assumption of a centrifugal force, for example. So,
That's right. We're having a. This is the. We've already got the centripetal force, and these are among the theorems about centripetal forces.
Well, once you devise a combination of a non-centripetal force and a n to the minus 2 law. That saves this phenomena, but that would be more complicated, I guess.
He actually has, the precession theorem has, I'm going to be focusing on what Carlin, we'll see it. He does have results about adding another force and what it would do, but I'm going to put off. Why don't you bring that back up if you think at the appropriate time? I won't rather than have me try to talk more. These things come together. There's a notion of acceptance that plays a big role in Newton's methodology and plays a tremendous role, I'm claiming, in cosmology today, in gravitation today. So here, and there's a notion of acceptance. It's provisional acceptance as a guide to research. Well, so this is Newton's fourth rule for reasoning in natural philosophy, as he calls it. In experimental, his version of it, contrasting to the so-called mechanical philosophy of Descartes and Huygens and Leibniz, propositions gathered from phenomena by induction should be considered either exactly or very nearly true. Now notice that acceptance doesn't mean you're committed to saying it's true forever and precisely. It can be accepted as an approximation. Notwithstanding any contrary hypotheses, so we'll go back to that, because that's until yet other phenomena make such propositions either more exact or liable to exceptions. A case of more exact are the agreeing measurements of what we can think of as the weak equivalence principle. Newton has pendulum experiments that are doing this for gravitation toward the Earth. He then has the moon test. He has the harmonic law for Jupiter's moons for the gravitation toward Jupiter. You can think of these as you inverse square adjust the acceleration to the distance of any moon, and you're getting agreeing measurements of the equal ratios in Newton's things of weight to mass of all those bodies. And the moon test, of course, is doing that for the moon. He has it for the primary planets from the harmonic law. Then he has these beautiful ones for the primary planets. If at this instant the weight of a moon of Jupiter towards the sun to its inertial mass were different from the ratio of Jupiter's weight toward its inertial mass, then the orbit would be polarized, either toward or away. Now, Newton cites a calculation, but doesn't give the details for it. The calculation we now know has to be wrong in the direction of the polarization and in the amount. Ken Nordvet developed the correct calculation. But if you put Newton's data with the correct calculation, you're getting bounds. So you can think of bounding Ockfass ratios, right? Bounding the differences of those accelerations are okay. And so you can think of the pendulum experiments giving bounds of about 1 part in 1,000. Later stuff by Bessel and then by Ottvash are giving bounds. I think 10 to the 7th and 10 to the 9th, or 10 to the 5th and 10 to the 9th. And then Moscow experiments, 10 to the minus 13th bounds on the differences.
So how about the moons of Jupiter, right?
And those are going along too. Newton, if you put the correct calculation with his, you're getting, you're bounding it to less than about 0.04 or something like that. I have it in the book. In Laplace, what's getting it to bound parts of 10 to the 7th. So bounding it from our moon, from looking at our moon. And then lunar laser ranging, 10 to the parts in 10 to the 12th, 10 to the 13th. I don't quite, but very similar. And this is a wonderful example of making the thing more exact, right? The more data, more measurements come in, and we keep bounding. So this is, at least some of the people I talked to think of this as the thing we know most solidly about gravity, is this feature of gravity. But okay, or liable to exceptions. Well, I'm gonna be talking about Mercury's perihelion, of course, for the famous exception. But in order to see how this works, you need to know what's the difference between a mere contrary hypothesis that should just not be taken to undercut the inference that you've got so far, that don't carry any weight to undercut the things that you're accepting now, and what should be counted as a serious rival? Because until you have that, then it's pretty hard to see what to do with this rule. So, I claim that the thing that does this is Newton's ideal of empirical success, convergent, accurate measurement of parameters by the phenomena. A mere hypothesis is something that doesn't realize this ideal of empirical success sufficiently well to count as a serious rival. So the vortex theory, it wasn't that they couldn't measure any vortical parameters. Huygens could actually measure on important parameter. If anybody's interested, I could tell.
Could you maybe explain what the vortex theory
is? Oh, I'm sorry. The vortex theory was, I think the first version that people paid a lot of attention to was by Descartes, suggesting that the planets are carried around the sun by a flow of vortical particles that are hitting on them, carrying them around. This is the way chips of wood in a whirlpool going around. And one of the neat things, I mean, Descartes does is to, how can you understand how you could have planets with moons, right? I mean, one of the things, Jupiter's moons were big. All of a sudden, you've got this thing being, and it's got another moon. But one of the things vortex theorists could do at that, I mean, this is later, but was looking at, sometimes you can see a big whirlpool with a little eddy going around, so that would shift. But what you're not doing, you're getting sort of qualitative analogies that are allowing you to see how it would be maybe possible to have the thing going by. But what you're not getting are actually carrying information in a strong way. You're not measuring the vortical parameters from the phenomena. Okay, so that's the... Now I'm going to group Mercury's perihelion before and after Einstein. Mercury's precession. Newton, in an early version of Book 3, The System of the World, that he then rewrote completely at the new Book 3, noted, no, planetary precession is no greater than what may easily arise from causes hereafter to be assigned, and what he was thinking were the perturbational interactions. Mercury's precession is about 574 seconds a century. 531 of those are due to Newtonian perturbations. And 43 are not explainable by Newtonian gravitation. Newcomb actually got this 43. Le Verrier had noted that at least 38 weren't explainable. And Newcomb got, Simon Newcomb, one of my great heroes. He was head of the US Naval Observatory in the late 1800s, early 1900s, through the transition. And these are from him. Okay. Now, the first thing, Hall's hypothesis. Asaph Hall, an American astronomer, proposed that the, applying Bertrand's formula to the case of Mercury, I find taking Newcomb's value for the motion, 43 seconds a cent, that the perihelion would move as the observations indicate by taking the power law, instead of being -2, it's -2.6016. Now it turned out at that time, this was compatible with all of the other information available. And now here you've got 1894, and you've got somebody's changing the inverse square law. And you've also got, and now the response to this, the next year, Newcomb published his theory of the inner planets and fundamental constants of astronomy. I don't know which order those come in the title, but this was the account of what the methodology and practice that had led to the dominance of the U.S. Naval Observatory as the place for ephemerides in the world, taking over from Greenwich, from Paris. They were better done here. And one of the things about it was he made is a central part of it was to come up with a single, consistent body of knowledge of relative masses of the solar system bodies. Le Verrier, and in those days, would use slightly different masses for different problems and wouldn't bother sort of trying to put it together. And this is Newton's methodology at work. Okay, Newcomb. In that, is he looks at problems, and of course the Mercury perihelion is a big problem. He just dismisses, like Vulcan, the little planet on the other side of the sun from us, so we never see it. Smash. Seelinger's hypothesis.
Sorry, because the numbers don't
match. No, he goes through all sorts of reasons why you couldn't find one there that would do the right job. And it's really pretty, you know, no bad. You know, a different thing is criticisms that really, Seelinger's hypothesis, this is, I've never seen it, but evidently at sunset, you can sometimes see little bits of light coming out from the sun along the plane of the ecliptic. Seelinger's hypothesis was that there are all these little particles there that just have the right mass and motion to give that extra precession to Mercury. Smash. I don't remember the details of the smash.
Smash
is Newcomb dismissing it, going through objections to it. And after smashing all these other ones, he comes to this, and he says, provisionally not inadmissible. Very high praise given what he's just done to everything else. And then he goes along and makes his predictive account agree with it. By the way, in order to do that, he had to introduce what we now know is extra precession on further outer planets. But that wasn't, you know, known at the time. Okay, so that's 1894. Now we come to Ernest Brown. Brown was busy refining Hill's theory of our moon's motion. The really precise theory of the moon's motion were done by Hill using extending a methodology invented by Hansen for handling perturbations at various. But at this point, if the new theoretical values of the motions of the moon's perigee and node are correct, the greatest difference between theory and observation is only 0.3 seconds, making delta are deviations from the inverse square. So the delta in the case of Hall would be 6 0 1 6. Notice 1 2 3 4 5 6 7 0. Such a value of delta is quite insufficient to explain the outstanding deviation in the motion of the perigee of Mercury. It appears then that this assumption must be abandoned. Now, I want to claim all three of the things. Yes, sorry.
When did they start using standard form notation?
Sorry?
When did people start using standard form notation? So when would this have become 4 times 7 minus 7?
I actually don't know. I'm not sure. I should know that. But what we've got here are all three of these things coming together here. I mean, of these features that I claim. You've got the measurement stuff, because I should say that Hall, that the Newton precession theorem is equivalent to Bertrand's. And so what Hall is doing is just giving the power law that would be measured by that precession, by that 43 seconds a century. And now you've got this measurement that's in effect getting the inverse square out a little better than another decimal place. So this is the, and you're accepting that this is inverse square, not just at the moon, but for gravity everywhere, fixing it this much. Since he's using it to reject Hall's hypothesis, which would do this for gravity toward the sun, and one of the things is that it's going to be the same power law for all, for gravity toward the Earth, for the Sun, for any planet.
This one is a stronger, this one is more important than the deviation from Mercer's square law for Earth's gravity or Sun's gravity.
Well, for Mercury, it's the Sun's gravity that matters.
Moon,
and he's getting this, he's got detailed information about the motion of the moon that's giving you a measuring the inverse square for gravitation toward the Earth out to another decimal place. And he's just applying that, of course, to the sun, too.
Okay.
And now he does say that, so the assumption must be abandoned or replaced by some other law of variation which will not violate the condition system. So we there stuck it. Okay. So we've got this thing about measure acceptance. You're now accepting the inverse square out to another decimal place, so that rules out Hall's hypothesis. Okay.
But is that really such a large extension? I mean, the moon really orbits the sun, and the Earth causes it to oscillate.
Yep.
So if this is really the, this is the delta on the inverse square law, it's dominantly the delta on the inverse square law to the sun.
Now, why is it that the much bigger centripetal acceleration that the moon has toward the sun and the Earth has toward the sun can be ignored in looking at this? Because they're equal and parallel, right? Almost. So they aren't, those accelerations are not making a difference in the relative motions between the Earth and the moon. They make a difference, but not. That's the, by the way, this is my favorite corollary of the laws of motion is corollary 6. That corollary 5 is the invariance with respect to Galilean transformations. Corollary 6 is even if you, in addition, add equal and parallel accelerations on all the bodies, that will make no difference at all in the relations among themselves. We can talk, okay, think, I want to, okay.
I mean, the sun's impact on the Earth's tides is as large as the
moon. Absolutely. In effect, Newton used the sun's impact on the tides is about half of the moon's, a little. And Newton was using this to give the first attempt that he had to measure the mass of the moon. That's another whole pretty interesting story. But let me go. I love talk. I mean, but let's okay. Go back. Okay. So now we go to 1915. GR accounts for the residual. I love that. These are from Pi's biography of Einstein. The first result was that his theory explains quantitatively the secular rotation of the orbit of Mercury discovered by Le Verrier without the need of any special hypotheses. This discovery was, I believe, by far the strongest emotional experience in Einstein's scientific life. Perhaps in all his life. Nature had spoken to him. He had to be right. For a few days, I was beside myself with joyous excitement. Later, he told Fokker that his discovery had given him palpitations of the heart. What he told De Haas is even more profoundly significant. When he saw that his calculations agreed with the unexplained astronomical observations, he had the feeling that something actually snapped in him. Now, many of you may know that the paper where he reported getting Mercury perihelion was published in early November of 1915. He did not yet have his field equation. What he had were constraints that would be appropriate for a roughly spherical mass distribution with the mass of the sun. And he's getting, in addition to the corrections from special relativity, the extra thing is the curvature of space at the distance of Mercury is what's getting you that amount. And 2 weeks later, he had the full field equation. I think this was a big inspiration for him to really get going. But that part is stuff I don't know enough about. But OK, but what I want to talk about this first, on this methodology, GR is, at that point, when Einstein got this, he had good grounds for thinking, well, first, it is the case that on Newton's own ideal of empirical success, GR is outdoing Newtonian gravity, and that Einstein had good reason for expecting that. The Newtonian limit of GR recovers the empirical successes of Newton's theory. Notice, if you didn't get those 531 seconds, then you're getting the 43 wouldn't help. There's a beautiful paper by George Smith called Testing Newtonian Gravity Then and Now. And it's It's available on the Stanford Philosophy Department website, and it's just beautiful. One of the things that George points out is the things that are, one of the things that Einstein's doing by is building in the Newtonian static weak field limit to recover all these successes of Newtonian gravity. And these include the successes, this long history of developing perturbations, and you've got the model so far. Now you look for deviations from that model. And then you find additional perturbational things that then are giving you that. And then you keep doing this step after step. So it's a series of successively better approximations. What George loves to point out, what did we really learn from Newton's theory? Well, all those details about what differences in masses and orbital, so like the great inequality is Jupiter-Saturn perturbation has a period of about 900 years, and it was Laplace that finally figured it out. And you're looking at where the...
can you explain what is not
The period. It's a periodic perturbation. The Jupiter and Saturn, I'll just talk about the center. The centers of their elliptical orbits are not exactly the center of the sun, and they're at different places. Okay, you've got these different things, and you've got and if you think of the and they have slightly different inclinations. So it turns out for about, Jupiter catches Saturn about every 20 years. It's 19 point something years. And for half of those, it's in a period when Jupiter is speeding up. So in those, after passing, Saturn's getting an increase of energy, and Jupiter's getting a decrease of energy. And then it switches. And the other half, it goes the other way. So for 450 years, you've got Jupiter being slowed down, Saturn sped up. And for the next 450 years, it's going the reverse way. And it turns out that these corrections that Halley and others had been making is because it happened to be at a period just before it switched. And I think it's by 1770 or something, Lambert showed that the corrections couldn't work. And that's just what started Laplace and using stuff from Lagrange. In fact, Lagrange, all of these people worked on Saturn, Jupiter. But finally, Laplace got this perturbational account, and it became periodic. But one of the things that gets carried over is all the details, all the significance about the causal things about this, what difference a detail would make. If you put I can't resist. I'm just going through to looking. The best account of this, of the Jupiter-Saturn perturbation is in a long paper written by Curtis Wilson. It's about 260 pages long. In the Archive for History of Exact Philosophy, Science, Archive for History of Exact Science. And it's a beautiful paper. He goes through the details of these things. But what these details get taken over by GR. So if you want to think of what did Newton's theory teach us, well, it was all these details, among other, okay. So now here's what I can't resist. This result, the fact that on Newton's method, on the method in place, GR is clearly outdoing Newton's theory. It makes trouble for certain interpretations for these famous quotes from Kuhn. Like the choice between competing political institutions, that between competing paradigms proves to be a choice between incompatible modes of community life. because it has this character, the choice is not and cannot be determined merely by the evaluated procedures characteristic of normal science, where these depend in part upon a particular paradigm, and that paradigm is at issue. When paradigms enter, as they must, into a debate about paradigm choice, their role is necessarily circular. Each group uses its own paradigm to argue in that paradigm's defense. Now, Einstein's enormous excitement over getting the mercury perihelion isn't because, oh, on some new notion of empirical success will favor my theory. No, it's on the thing in place now I'm beating it. And it's not clear that the natural interpretation of this that suggested that these revolutionary changes in science are not guided by evidence. It's not clear that Kuhn really intends that. I had one discussion with him in which he said he didn't. But this was taken up by a whole tradition to look, so Kuhn has established that scientific transformations aren't guided by evidence, or aren't sufficiently guided by evidence. And so I want to, I think it's important to see that on this methodology, clearly there's no problem with the transition.
So this page is not applicable to what happened.
That's right. It raises real problems since Kuhn in his later years stopped using the notion of paradigm. But a paradigm of a paradigm shift is a transition from Newtonian gravity to GR.
You don't think it's a paradigm?
Well, no, Kuhn stopped wanting to use the term and stuff. No, I think it's a good example of, and the important thing is that the skeptical conclusions suggested by this are not, there's real problem for those when you just look at this transition that we were just looking at. Okay, sorry, I'm taking too long.
Can I just ask a question? So to make clear, you're suggesting that the paradigm shift is not triggered by evidence, it's triggered...
No, no, I'm saying it is triggered by evidence. This suggests that evidence isn't what's playing the role. And in particular, it might be the need for the paradigm shift. I mean, Kuhn always thought that might be triggered. Right. But the transition, the justification of changing from Newtonian gravity to GR, this quote suggests, can't be fixed by evidence, but has to be more like politics or something. And that's what I'm challenging. And I'm challenging it by saying, look, on the story we were telling about the Newtonian method, it endorses the transition. So Newton's method endorses the transition from his theory to Einstein's, once the mercury perihelion stuff. So even though his theory is no longer the accepted theory, except as approximations and as we said, the weak field static weak field limit, it isn't the methodology I'm claiming is still going on, and I want to now illustrate it going on in GR stuff with.
Maybe just to add your point, I mean there are a few examples of these great debates that I know in science that like the prominent scientists debate the nature of different things. That the only examples that I know, either the debate was a tie or actually the person who cannot be wrong won the debate. So,
good.
So I guess this debates are not really the best way of settling scientific questions. I guess that's just kind of my personal, but maybe you have a different.
Yeah. No. What I do think is that it's important. I mean, there was a whole group for a while, a few years ago, they were dominant in history of science, that were taking Kuhn to have shown, and that science is all just a bunch of stories. It's not guided by evidence.
The famous example is the debate in gamma ray bursts that whether they are extragalactic or some phenomenon inside the galaxy. And I think it was Bortoluczynski and Lamb. I forgot his first name. Anyway, so there's this big debate, and apparently everybody believed Lamb, but I guess he eloquently argued for gamma ray bursts being some phenomenon inside the galaxy, and a couple of years later, they actually rediscovered the outside the galaxy. And that's, I guess, one example.
Yeah.
All the other ones that I know, they have been my kind of like this.
Yeah, what you want is the long-term bearing of evidence that accumulates over a long time that's going to do the.
So you talk about this evidence like it's not uncertain. So whenever I hear about a new result,
yeah,
new results are hard to make. I mean, if they're
right.
easy, we wouldn't need smart people doing it.
Right.
So they're very hard, and they come with all of these systematic uncertainties, all of these underlying assumptions that go into the measurement.
Right.
And people are free to choose how much they believe these stated uncertainties. And if you play a bifactor too, hey, it's consistent with anything, and that's okay. In retrospect, once we've settled on a model for some phenomena, we know, okay, well, those uncertainties were right, those ones were wrong, and you know, now we have our story. But at the time, people often seem to choose. They're biased by their predisposition. They choose how they feel about a given set of observations. Which ones are important?
You're inciting me to say two things. Okay, the first is the I'm claiming that the really serious weight of evidence comes after the initial thing with as the way things build up, and the initial thing. I mean, think of Newtonian gravity, the enormous weight of evidence from this long history of dealing with all these perturbations. And you're finding out more things about the details that make a difference and all. And okay, so it's certainly true that if you just take the evidence that Newton marshaled in the initial argument, that's swamped by the later evidence. And it also is true that some of the Schaffer and his friends, the sociology thing, are often point out that the very initial things, say it's for example the light bending, the very first ones, now they kind of make it look worse than it is in the book, but it's not very powerful at that point. I grant you that. But it gets supported to more and more detail later. But I also want to say that, I mean, when I was talking about, at this point, Einstein had good grounds for thinking his theory would be able to beat Newton's. And we, of course, there's all kinds of additional stuff that was going on. And in fact, let me do that one of the other additional things, because I'm trying to get... Okay, so sorry, I got carried away. But I do want to talk about, this is another case. The nice thing about Mercury, you can see the methodology at work in JR. So the Brain-Sticky alternative to JR, inspired by Mach, introduces a parameter omega to represent contribution of distant stars to local curvature of space. Gamma, the amount of space curvature per unit. By the way, this is in the... I'm setting this up in the PPN formalism. So this is a system of approximations appropriate for the field strength in the vicinity of our solar system, relatively close to the sun. You have to use a quite different formalism for binary pulsars. It's called the PPK. But here you've got, okay, so gamma, amount of space curvature unit rest mass, is one of these things. And in the Brain-Sticky theory, gamma is 1 plus omega divided by 2 plus omega. Now, it's the bigger omega gets, the less and less effect the distant stars are having. Because notice that in GR, it's fixed at 1. And notice as omega goes to infinity, you're going to recover GR in the limit. Okay, now, in Dickey and Goldenberg in 1966, we're doing observations of solar oblateness that suggested that about 4 seconds a century of Mercury's precession is due to the to a rapidly rotating inner core of the sun. Now, a Brain-Sticky theory setting omega with 5 will predict about 39 seconds a century. So it was looking like the initial great triumph for Newton, for GR, was going to be its undoing. But Shapiro carried out, he called it a fourth test of GR, and radar time delay. So if you're bouncing a radar signal, say, off of Venus when it's going close to the sun versus when it's further away, it takes a long, like in the, if you're just setting it up, you have a straight line thing, but it's really traveling in a more of a curve because of the curvature. And so you have a time delay versus there when it's at maximum elongation. And these results were measuring gamma to be 1 plus or minus 0.002, or this forces any version of omega to have to be over about 489. In fact, now I think there are things from loser laser ranging that's up, I don't know, 2 or 3,000. It's no longer significantly different. Brain Sticky cannot simultaneously accommodate mercury perihelion setting it at 5 and Shapiro time delay. And notice this is just like Brown ruling out Hall. So the very same methodology at work. Okay, now I'm sorry to have taken so long, so let me quickly go through the application here. You guys all know this, the FLR, Friedman, Lemaitre, Robertson, Walker, dust solution to Einstein at scales at which clusters of galaxies can be treated as expected specks of dust. Omega total is omega sub m, ordinary mass energy, omega sub lambda, which is this weird stuff, dark energy. Having the total be 1 corresponds to Euclidean flat space.
This is
what? Oh, yeah. Oh, no, not the local. It's not locally flat. It's flat. I mean, each. Good. Oh, yes. Good. And okay. Combining results 1. The example is from this thing. Here you've got a case for. So notice that you've got the. Okay, across the bottom, we have omega sub m. By the way, notice the having that omega sub m be about 0.3, and these a lot of dark matter, because around 0.03 would be the visible sources of mass energy. And here is the omega lambda, and of course the flat is going to correspond to this line. And here you have measurements from galaxies. Here you have the cosmic microwave background radiation, and here you have the supernova redshift measurements, and here you can see them all coming together. Now, I want to talk about research impact 1. Agreeing measurements raise the bar on alternative cosmological proposals. They also set the standard for alternative theories like gravity and Mond-Tevis. Tevis is just the relativistic extension of Mond. Can they capture existing successes and produce new agreeing measurements elsewhere? One of the alternative proposals, of course, would be David Wilcher's proposal that we're sort of in a little ball, a little local ball where we're getting misleading stuff. Unless, I'm claiming, unless one of those proposals, unless they can find actually details, phenomenal stuff that would actually directly support it, and that, of course, that would be like finding a real problem for them, or can develop their own measurements sufficiently to be counted as a serious rival, it doesn't carry any weight to undercut. Okay. Now, combining results 2. This is from later stuff from Suzuki. These two diagrams, I really love these. This is a little bit later, but this is the diagram corresponding to the first one. And you can see they've got things even better, a little more. This is a diagram where they introduce worries about systematic errors. Notice how much fatter the error bounds now for the supernova redshift. But the combined thing is still pretty close to being in the same place.
But now we said that supernova don't have not very much wrong.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, I'll let you guys, I won't try to settle that. But what I do want to say is that this exhibits another impact. The WMAP affords increased resiliency of the specific combined measurement result. This illustrates a further important advantage from agreeing measurements from diverse phenomena. Even if you become committed to this kind of, you're still getting the, okay. And, okay.
Doesn't this go against it? So exactly the idea that then you presented with the Newton's method, that you want to have many experimental tests of something all converging on the same spot.
Yeah.
So in the first picture, we have three that converge reasonably well. And in
yeah.
the second picture, we have two that set it, right? It's really EAO and CMB.
And but you're still getting, well, wait a minute. No, you're still getting, notice where that spot is, though, with respect to the supernova measurements. It's just that the supernova measurements, you now got more worries that are about systematic error that are making you less confident about the bounds. But you're still getting that. So I'm claiming that it's still this, in a certain sense, the supernova measurements are still backing up these other two, in the sense that they provide more resistance from things that are widely different than you would have with just those alone. The kind of resiliency of the result. Okay, all right, there, I'll stop here. I'm sorry I took so long, and I probably being unfair to tout my book, but there it is. Yes.
How does being a Bayesian fit into all of this? In that, from what Avery was saying, I would say at any time you're saying, I think you're not driven by evidence. You're driven by evidence, but you're just heavily reliant on your prior as well. But you know,
yeah.
I mean, and it just fits in perfectly with what you said. Then in the limit of infinite evidence, your priors don't matter. So this is all just a Bayesian story. I mean, could you replace Newton's methodology just with
okay, good. I made, one of Newton's opponents, Huygens, has a wonderful statement of a version of the hypothetical deductive methodology that's sort of a Bayesian line. I'll just say he has just this terrific quote from Huygens giving one of the differences between Huygens and Descartes. Where Descartes, you're just thinking of a possible story that would make sense out of it. Huygens thinks that those possible stories, if they're predicting new phenomena, and especially new phenomena that weren't expected, then those are increasing your confidence, right? And Huygens was one of the initial Bayesians. He wrote what Dick Jeffrey, a philosopher who's Bayesian, thinks was the first Bayesian textbook in probability. And so he goes through, so suppose that you had something that you thought wouldn't happen and you're surprised that it does and it was coming from, the theory would have predicted something that otherwise would have been really unexpected. All these are things where Bayesian conditionalization would give big boosts to the probability, to the posterior probability. Well, all you guys are familiar with, I'm sure you're all familiar with Bayesian. So Huygens, what I'm claiming is that there's a role played by acceptance and system provisional acceptance, and then revising what you accept, that is in the Newton's methodology, that to do justice to the story I've been telling about Newton's methodology and its role in the history of science, Bayesians will have to get an account of acceptance. I actually believe that a Bayesian account could be very informative and could inform our and acceptance can't just be assigning probability one. Being somebody that easily gets confident about things and then find out later, I needed to be taught that Wayne Myhrvold, a colleague of mine, pointed out that, look, suppose this room were really sealed, right? And the probability, I wanted to think of acceptance as either your degree of belief is one or it's infinitesimally close to one. And you can do beautiful models of the thing with infinitesimally close. You can get all kinds of neat stuff. So Wayne said, okay, that on kinetic molecular theory, there's a non-infinitesimal probability that, say, in the next 5 minutes, all the air molecules would go into a corner. But I'm confident that I accept that that doesn't happen. Or no, are you more confident about, in thinking, guiding, I forgot what he had, more confident about whatever I was accepting than that? Am I more confident, more sure that some version of the FLRW model, say, will keep being the right theory in large-scale cosmology? Am I more confident about that than I am that all the, that in the next hour all the molecules aren't going to go in the corner? Probably not. So we have a role for acceptance, but where acceptance isn't just indication of how high my epistemic probability is. And I think that Bayesians might be able to give an informative account that would add to our understanding of this role of acceptance. But the basic Bayesian model without it, I don't think can do justice to the kind of quality of evidence, this role of evidence in guiding theory change that I've been talking about.
Other questions for Bill? Well, I guess Bill's going to be here for the rest of the day.
I think it's going to storm, so I'll be around for a little bit, but
okay.
I think we should start.
But the next kids are casting if you want to
talk. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's thank you again.
By the way, I want to just say, I shouldn't have left it on this. I want to, on this stuff about sources of error, Dylan wrote a dissertation on, with Wayne Myhrvold and me, on looking at the systematic errors associated with the supernova redshift and the systematic errors in the WMAP, and arguing that except for, maybe I even have
except for some very strange proposals. They're all independent.
They're very independent. And to the extent that you're getting agreeing measurements where you have grounds for thinking that the systematic errors are independent, then the agreement of the measurements is giving you more grounds than you had before that neither is a mere artifact of its systematic error. And so he also has a really beautiful paper on Phillips untangling some problems with the supernova redshifts. You guys might want to have him come and give a talk.